Welcome to the Eschatology Podcast. This is Clifton, and I am here with Travis Chin, owner of IASCA Worldwide. Welcome, Travis.
Thank you.
When I first got involved in IASCA, I think it was around the time that Paul Papadakis had first taken over IASCA. I think that was around 2001 or so. And then I was gone for a while. And then I would say since I've been back in 2012, when I started competing again, seriously, Travis has been at pretty much every major event since then. And he's been no stranger judging different eschatology events. He's here now with us in Knoxville, Tennessee, for the show that we are doing at Sound Factory here in Knoxville. This is our fourth event we've done here. And Travis has been gracious enough to travel out among the COVID-19 issues that we're having right now, potentially being quarantined when he gets home for 2 weeks. So we appreciate the sacrifices for sound quality out here. But Travis, give us a little background on yourself. What kind of got you into car audio in the first place?
As a kid, I played instruments, piano, trumpet, drums, violin. And then through high school, I started messing around with professional audio, getting onto the high school stage crew. So kind of messing with big equipment. And of course, then I started driving. Definitely loved music, so I needed to have music while I was driving. So got in the car audio then. And then when it came to competition, it was my freshman year in college. I just happened to go to a show with a friend. It was at Mobile Audio in Kent, Washington. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And after that, you know, I started buying more equipment and visiting Mobile Audio. And they kind of helped me to get my system to a competition level. And then I started competing in 94 and did that for a few years. And then I think it was 97 was when someone told me that I should go attend a judge's training just to learn about the rules so that I can get better. And so I went and I did it in 97 and 98. And then 98 was when they were looking for more judges. So then they started asking me to actually judge, and kind of took off from there, where I did more judging than I did competing, and I don't think I've competed since then.
Yeah, because you've been a judge as long as I've known you. So what did your first system consist of?
Oh, man. For my head unit, I had Alpine 7618. Then I had that Alpine DSP that kind of matched with that the green buttons and all right. Okay. I think it was the 3319. I have both of those still in bins in my garage.
Oh, wow.
Had Ambicort separates up front, coaxials in the back, JL subs. I think I had 10s. And then Phoenix Gold, M25, and M44. Eventually went to an M50 from the M25. Had the 215X. So 15-band crossover with the EQ,
right.
Line driver. Yeah, I think that was it.
Being that you were competing, it sounds like around 94 to 97 era, I assume that was when you're kind of competing everything. So it was a bit of sound quality, a bit of loud, a bit of install, a bit of RTA.
Yeah. It was the full score sheet.
Right. Was there a place you gravitated to during that time, once things broke out more in the late 90s to early 2000s, and that especially, did you find yourself gravitating towards sound quality or SPL more or less, or kind of just still all of it? Were you judging SPL and sound quality when you kind of first got into it?
So the SPL stuff, I didn't do that till 2012.
Okay.
You know, that was when it really broke off and you have an SPL crowd.
Right.
An SQ crowd, and your shows were, for the most part, separate.
Right.
So
even if they were together, they were still kind of separate.
Yeah. Yeah, I was probably more SQ because install seemed to be more for those that were professional installers.
Right.
I was still in college. I didn't have much money, so I couldn't pay for for a really good install. And I didn't have much time either, or the tools, because broke college student.
Right.
Yeah, I just really love SQ. You know, that was where my background was, playing all these instruments. And I'm like, wow, you know, I can actually hear it in the car really close to actually as if I were playing.
So when you were competing through being a judge and everything, I've only known you as an IASCA judge, but was there any other organizations that you played with when you were up there? Was it mostly IASCA, or what was kind of your background in terms of the organization?
I mean, it was pretty much all IASCA is all I knew about. So if there were other organizations around, I didn't know. I kind of knew a little bit about DB Drag as time went on.
Right.
You know, as I was judging more, because I think I did quite a bit up until 2005. Okay. So, and I know there were some DB Drag events, but to me, that was SPL.
Right.
It wasn't something that I could judge. I didn't have a term lab, so I couldn't even try to dabble with it. And then about, I think it was 2006 was when I actually moved from Seattle to Central Washington. And I remember at that point, it was right after I had judged my first finals in 2005 in Kansas City. And I just had to tell Mo, I said, hey, I got to pause judging because I'm moving my whole family and I'm actually really getting into my career. And I was like, I got to focus on that. So I did that for a while and then came back. I think it was 2011. Mo did a judge's training in Vancouver, Washington. Okay. So I went down there and did that and judged and kind of took off again from there, doing a lot of judging.
Now, were you doing much event hosting at that point, or were you just judging for other hosts, or what? How? When did you get into the event side?
So I was doing... I was always one of those judges waiting to be called up until, I think it was 2012. So it was right after that training. You know, there was nobody in the Northwest that was able to put on a show or knew how to. So I went and I figured out, where do I get trophies? What do I need to do to actually put on my own show? And kind of asked around who wanted to host a show. And Jesse at Audio Northwest was like, sure, I'll do it.
Right.
And of course, both of us didn't really know what to expect. We did SPL and SQ, and we also added, we had Luke Paddle judge DB Drag. Okay. And man, we took over not just the property he was on, but we had parking in the grass to the restaurant next door and in their parking lot.
You were making everybody happy.
Yeah. Even the apartment building behind us, they called the cops like two or three times because of the SPL guys. So yeah, that was our first show. And boy, did we learn a lot from that one.
And you did quite a few. You were doing a dozen or more events in a year there for a while, weren't you?
I mean, yeah.
It seemed like you were pretty much every weekend there for a bit during the summer.
Yeah, it was once that happened, everybody was like, I want a show in my city. So everybody just went around to all the different shops. And, you know, there were quite a few guys who were in the mini truck culture,
right,
stuff. And of course, all these mini truck clubs were putting on all their shows and they wanted stereo contests and a big crowd like this show. So they added it to their shows, and all these shops wanted to do it. And, you know, we were doing shows. Yeah. I think from 2013 to 15 or 16, we had almost one every weekend.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And you were driving from Central Washington.
Yeah.
Over the pass just to get, I mean, what was it? Three, 4 hour drive.
Yeah. At least I think the closest show was 2.5 hours away.
So. That's a lot of time, but it certainly was appreciated by a lot of people, I know, because it built up the car audio culture up there like it had never been before. I mean, because even in the 90s, most of the culture, because I was in Seattle in the 90s, and I was a little bit younger at the time, but I still seemed like most of the cardio scene was in the Southeast and through the South, and from Texas to Georgia up to, you know, the Carolinas and that. It didn't seem like we saw stuff in the magazines, and there were some events, maybe a bigger event here or there, but there wasn't the stuff like what you were doing where you could hit an event every weekend. When did Surf City come about then?
Oh, boy. I'm trying to remember. So it started... So Scott McRae, he's now the marketing director of the Chinook Winds Casino, which hosts Surf City. And he started doing it, I think it was 2010. Okay. So it was before I knew him. And I don't remember exactly which organizations he had, but it wasn't IASCA. And then we had the training in Vancouver, Washington in 2011. And then I think we – so that was at – Streamline Audio, and then we went and did a show there in 2012 again at Streamline, which is the closest show to the Chinook Winds Casino out on the Oregon coast. Scott had set up a booth there at our show at Streamline, and we got to talking, and he just said, hey, do you want to come out and bring IASCA to Surf City? And so that, I think it was early fall that year, we had went out there. It was primarily DB drag. And so that was the first time IASCA was out there. Was its third year, 2012. It was kind of interesting because during 2012, that was our first boom year, and we had these huge shows, and we go there, and it was like everybody wanted to do DB drag, and nobody wanted to do IASCA. Even though all these people had came to our IASCA shows, there were a lot of people from California too, and they all did DB drag. So over all these years, it's kind of transitioned because we've been keeping IASCA going through in the Northwest. That is completely flipped now, that it's more heavily towards IASCA. Still quite a bit in DB drag, but we're also gaining SQ competitors.
I'm going to say, because you've been like in the 30s for SQ cars, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And mostly it's SPL guys who want to give SQ a try.
Right.
So
that's good to see. And that's Surf City is primarily a car show plus the SPL, or is it mostly car audio, or is it how's it break down?
So it's kind of more of who do you talk to?
Which crowd do you ask?
Yeah. I mean, if you talk to a car audio person, most likely they're going to say it's an SPL show because there's so many SPL competitors. We had...
like Slamology.
Yeah, I think we had 80 just doing IDBL. So it's heavily towards the SPL crowd, mostly because it's one of the shows that they can demo at full blast for several hours. And we save that for Sunday. SQ is Saturday, and then when we're done with SQ, we give them about an hour to do SPL demos.
It seems like maybe the first year or so there was a couple little issues, but it seems like you guys have really, at least we don't hear about it. Once you got through, kind of figured out the scenario and what made everybody happy, it seems like everybody comes out happy. So
yeah, this show is just so different from every show that I've been to that there's like 100% respect among everybody.
That's great.
I mean, if you have guys who they were like just about ready to box at another show because they just hate each other's guts, they come to Surf City and it's gone. There is no rivalry. There's no hate. You know, everybody helps each other. Even people that don't know each other, they will just swap equipment. If somebody blows something, right, they'll help tune each other's car. And then everybody gets together, usually Saturday night, sometimes Friday night, for a bonfire down on the beach.
That's cool.
You know, but it's just this big, it's more like a party,
right,
than a competition. You know, there's hardly any people hating.
And you get quite a few people coming up from California as well as down from Canada, right? I mean,
yep,
it has a pretty good pull as far as people traveling.
Yeah, and the past few years, we've actually had people flying out from the East Coast.
Oh, wow.
So quite a few people.
Right. That's awesome. That was probably the biggest car audio event that happened this year, right?
Yeah. Yeah, luckily we didn't really get the COVID restrictions. That actually probably helped this year become so big, especially with the classic car show that happened Saturday. They actually had, because everybody wanted to go to a car show and all of theirs got canceled except for this one.
Right.
So everybody came out, and I think the classic car show, they doubled their show space to fit all the cars. And then Sunday, we added a lowrider show to it, and they took a huge chunk of the parking lot too. So yeah, it's just grown, and yeah, COVID kind of helped it in that aspect.
To back up a little bit here, it must have been somewhat surreal coming from when you started competing in the early mid-90s and then started judging, and then obviously you've gotten much more involved since then on the event side. Even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you probably wouldn't have seen yourself as the current owner of IASCO Worldwide. Travis, for reference, I think took over after finals last year, so just in time for COVID to happen and shut down all the events worldwide, which has been, I'm sure, had its challenges. Were there any goals in mind in your mind going into it, as far as, was there a transition in your head? Because, I mean, you're already doing a lot with IASCO before that. You were already involved a lot with finals. You were involved a lot with rules. You were involved a lot with rules and ethics and everything else. So it seems like the transition was fairly natural, especially since you have a lot of involvement on both the sound quality and the SPL sides. I don't think there's, I would say most of them are on the West Coast, but I mean, like the Papasans in California on the Mecca side are maybe the only other ones I can think of offhand who are really actively involved on both the sound quality and the SPL sides, because out here, most of the event directors, especially central and eastern states, it seems like you have the people who are very focused on the SPL side and kind of do the sound quality if they have to, or they're very focused on the sound quality side and do the SPL if they have to, and it's very broken up, whereas it seems like you and, again, the Popsons with Mecca in California are really the only ones in the country that have successfully kept the two going in unison. Was it opportunity knocked and you accepted, or is there something, a bigger goal in mind of taking over IASCO, or what are your thoughts and plans and hopes and dreams in that regard?
Boy, if you had asked me 2 or 3 years ago if I ever would see myself as the owner of IASCO, and I'd probably say probably not. Yeah, it was, I don't see it so much as being the owner as it is just kind of being the caretaker.
Okay. Yeah.
And I feel that one of my attributes is being organized, trying to be organized, because if you look at my garage, I'm not organized. But trying to organize and make things flow efficiently. And I'm talking not just car audio or IASCO, just stuff in general. And that's kind of what I thought that I could bring to IASCO to maybe help it progress into the future. There's a lot of other things that I know about that could possibly help with IASCO. One of it is I have the knack to just find things at a good deal. so which kind of helped with COVID, during COVID, because it was like funding really was minimized this year with that. And it's kind of like,
nobody's looking to spend marketing budget on events that may or may not happen.
Right. So it's like, okay, how do I save money? And so there's different things, like my career is in statistics. And so there's database work that I'm always doing. So I kind of knew how to keep the scoring database going. Okay. But just like you guys with your systems, I've like rebuilt the queries for my reports like multiple times over and over and started over and things like that. So you're probably going, what's changed? And it's, yeah. So there's different things that that I have knowledge in that hopefully helps it keep going. Yeah. So last spring, I just happened to be talking to Paul and I just said, hey, if there comes a time that you're looking to hand off Ayahuasca, just keep me in mind. And it wasn't long after that, there were some life changes for Paul and he was looking to pass it on and it just kind of worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about it before, but Ayahuasca is a great entity in that regard, in that it is its own entity. Everybody kind of sees Ayahuasca as what they view Ayahuasca as a piece of what their history in competition, whatever that is. And it's very regional. It's more personal. Most people on the everyday level who have competed and been involved may or may not even know who Paul Papadias is or whatever. You know, it's not tied to an individual, whereas Ayahuasca is just seen as this thing that has been synonymous with cardio competition for most everybody's memory at this point. And so I think it's phenomenal that it has taken the course it has just to keep it, the continuation going, because we've all seen it with other organizations that have been sold and it crashes and burns when you don't have the person who was the soul of that organization keeping it going, good or bad. So I think it's great that nobody has seen it as, I would say, any kind of life-changing difference in how the organization is perceived. I think there was more of a perceptual difference when Paul first took it over than there was when you took it over, just because there was that, you know, he came in as somebody who was an event promoter doing it and didn't really have a vested interest in the organization beforehand. So, okay, are you just going to make this to work better for SBN? Where are you going with this now? Whereas, you know, your involvement with cardio in general has been consistent through the years. You've always been a supporter of Ayahuasca. It's not like you were like, oh, here's an opportunity. I think in a lot of ways, Ayahuasca was already synonymous with who you are, or at least how you're perceived in the industry. So I think we're all grateful for you taking on the challenge, especially considering what none of us could have predicted when you first took on the challenge this year going the way it has. But hopefully that'll kind of give some opportunity later on. Do you have any kind of vision in where you would like to take things with Ayahuasca, or are you looking to more just develop and hone what's there and make it more efficient, or what is your vision with it?
Well, first I want to make sure that we keep the consistency of the judging and the fairness with our scoring. Because if you lose focus of that or you push it to a lower priority, that will hurt Ayahuasca pretty bad. So the thing is to maintain that. So of course we're going to do more judges trainings and just kind of make sure all of our judges are on the same page.
And that's difficult too, especially with Ayahuasca, because there's so many people who identify themselves as an Ayahuasca judge who right. How many things might have changed from the time that they went through training and kind of understood all those things to now.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make them a good or bad judge. It's just a matter of making sure that everybody, like you said, is on the same page as far as where Ayahuasca is in evaluating the sound now.
Right, just keeping them up to date. So that's one future goal. You know, I always say, if you take care of yourself or your own product, and you do the best you can, then everything else will fall into place. And so we'll just continue to tweak the rules. You know, make sure that they still fit. Keep them up to date with, you know, just how things are trending, and find out if there's ways to get more competitors while maintaining all of the current members right there too. So you know, we've done a lot of stuff in the Northwest. You know, I've done a few things with Jesse at Audio Northwest. So, you know, I always bring him up because he's been really helpful in us trying to figure out how to grow it in the Northwest, because he was there from the beginning when I started doing shows on my own. So yeah, we just try different tricks. We're always trying to get new people in, because you can't grow without new competitors.
Right.
We're kind of looking at how do we get other retailers involved, get more manufacturers involved. That kind of faded away when the economy kind of took a dump. So,
well, or the manufacturers are selling through all the product they have, and they don't even have any more product to sell. So like, well, right. Now what?
Right.
We can't sell them more if we had it.
Yeah. So it's kind of trying to bring everybody back on board.
Right. What do you perceive as possible methods to achieve that growth? Is it dialing things in more with the people that are involved now? Is it branching out into different areas? Is it just doing more shows in more areas? What do you think is...
Of course, it's a mix of everything. Yeah. But one of the things that I'm looking into is how do we improve the different types of memberships? The industry membership and the retailer membership? Mm-hmm. Is there something that I could offer more to them, just to get them more involved, to get their name out there more?
Right. Where they can use IASCA as more multifaceted in their business versus just an occasional event that pops up.
Right. So I've got different ideas. Of course, it's stuff that I've learned from maybe from helping organize Surf City, just being around, helping organize with finals and stuff. So all of that stuff that I've learned over the past few years, you know, how do I take that and improve those membership types?
Right. What do you think for competitors who are competing out here, for example, where we have a lot of shows that are Mecca and IASCA, and especially on the sound quality side, the number one thing that comes up is, you know, I win in Mecca and then I get fifth place in IASCA. Why? And I haven't really come up with a real good answer for that, other than the music's different, it's judged a different loudness, that kind of thing. But, you know, how do you have any suggestions for that competitor that doesn't quite know how to win an IASCA event yet?
Yeah, I think part of it is with some of these trainings. So one of the things that I want to offer to at least the retailer memberships and the possibly the industry memberships is to offer clinics. Okay. And to do that maybe ahead of some of these bigger shows.
Right.
And, you know, that will help with retailers and getting people to their stores. So then these competitors will learn what we're looking for, and if they need help, hopefully the retailer can help them out.
Right. So basically having somebody who's qualified there to evaluate a system on a more casual basis versus going through a competition judging scenario.
Right. So it's not just just compete, take the feedback, go work on it, here's come back number. To another show. Yeah. You know, that's like trial and error pretty much.
Just keep throwing darts at it until it comes out.
Yeah.
Whereas this way, so what for on the judging side of things, because obviously you have different ears and different vehicles and everybody has kind of a different set of references they're working off of and everything. I guess how do you get everybody on the same page as to what IASCA is looking for that better scoring system to be? And how do you achieve that consistency across so many different sets of ears and experiences?
All right. So when we did our training back at the end of February, right when COVID hit, we were trying out a few different things to see how we can improve the judges' training. And we not only went through just the rules kind of line by line, right, but we also tried to add more to the listening. And so we also had a studio set up, kind of a reference. And of course, everyone who was there got to sit and listen, and we talked through it. I had found some videos that were not exactly the recording, but kind of close. To give the judges kind of a visual of this is how the stage is spread with the different instruments and the vocals. This is how they're playing the instrument. We had done that. Then we also spent the last day actually sitting in cars that we had at the training. And then the very next day, we actually had a competition, and Keith and I sat with the potential judges and kind of walked through them in several types of cars. So what we would hope is that after that, that there would be maybe another event or two that Keith and I or somebody would sit with these judges some more and just get more experience. But you really only get it by sitting in different cars. So
lots of different reference points on what creates a balanced system.
Yeah.
It sounds like more than anything, just having familiarity with the criteria itself, with the software, with the music and everything else that's presented on the ASCII disc, plus training the rules and definitions are applied is kind of what you're after.
Yeah. And just kind of listening at the, say, different levels of scoring.
Right.
As much as we want new judges or even the older judges to listen and know what a great sounding car is,
right,
we also want them to listen to a bunch of really, really bad cars.
So it's almost more difficult to put a score on the mediocre than it is on the excellent. It's the excellent, you're at the top of the range. It's not so bad, but you kind of have to nitpick. But when you get that in what I would say in the 180 to 200 middle of the ground road, it's like, how do you, differentiating between average is more difficult.
Like, who should be third and who should be sixth place, you know? Right.
Yeah, first and last is usually easy enough. It's just the third through fifth that gets more technical. So to pan back out here a second, what's one of or some of the most memorable moments you've had in your years of competition?
Okay, one that always sticks out, it was, I think, 2014 finals in Indy.
Yeah,
I think.
Cold.
Yeah. Well, we
2013, I think. No, 2000. You're right.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Anyway,
but it was
2012 was Indy.
Oh, was it 12?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
I think it was a DB drag and IASCA one, and so we had SPL in the same building, and
carbon monoxide everywhere.
Yeah, and I think we were pushing all the installs to be later in the day,
right?
During the SPL judging, it was still too loud, so we pushed everybody doing install outside
in the 30-degree weather.
Yeah, and okay, so I know everybody, most judges do not want to judge install. I think it's just because everybody just loves sound. I was kind of pushed to do install. And I remember I had to judge Scott Buwalda. And we were outside. And Scott is such a perfectionist that I had started the timer when he started. And of course, this was when it was still early on when I hadn't seen that many cars nationwide yet.
Right.
You're
mostly focused in the Northwest.
Right. Okay. And so I was kind of fascinated with the install, you know, because of Scott. I had started the timer and I'm just listening to him. I'm not paying attention to this timer. And he's going and we're going through the car, and I think we got to the trunk. I could tell he was getting close to the end, and I said, oh, crap, I need to look at my watch. And I looked, and right as he said the last word, I think, was right when I looked at it, and he had hit it. I think it was 15 minutes, and it was 14:59. And I was like, what the heck? I was like, this guy must practice, like, in his sleep with a timer. And so yeah, once that happened, I was like, boy, these guys at a national level, they really, you know, take it to the next. Yeah.
I think that was during that same install presentation that he threw the back seat across the way too, when he was showing the fusing underneath the rear seat. Was that when he threw the back seat out of the car?
Is that when it was?
I think so.
Maybe I was so busy listening to
him. I remember I was actually looking the other direction. I was talking to some other people, and I just remember hearing this crash, look around, the back seat's flying across the across the alley.
Yeah.
Anyway. What about the shows and, you know, in the Northwest that you were starting out? Is there anything memorable that happened up there in terms of, like, during that growth period, or somebody that started out, that came off the street, ended up doing bigger things or anything like that?
Yeah. Oh, man. There are so many stories. You know, obviously that first one at Audio Northwest, that's always a story to tell. Surf City, man, that show has so many stories in itself every year. There's so many that I can't even, yeah. Several people would blow up their stuff and someone would come in and just be like, use this. Somebody that like they don't even know. But I think there's just too many different things. And
so what, backing up a little bit, what is it about the cardio competition and the judging side of things and the events in that you think intrigued you into just to keep doing it? Because I mean, I would say there's a fair amount of people who go between competing to judging to doing a couple events, and then they get burnt out and then they go away. they realize that there's no fame and fortune here. And then they go do something else because, you know, you basically spend your life making everybody sad. but seriously, I mean, I think you're one of the few people I know who has just judged the entire time, you know, without building a car, without, you know, doing something in between. And you've built your reputation on your judging and your event promotion alone. There was nothing, you know, nobody was like, oh, because, I mean, the whole thing that got me going as far as judging was, like, I competed in my car for a little bit. And it's like, oh, he has a good-sounding car, so yeah, you can judge. And it was kind of like this grandfather thing, you know, that happened. Right. Whereas it sounds like you really you dabbled in the competition side, and then you found judging, and then you found event promotion. And it seems like that's when you really grew in the industry, and it's not, you're not in the industry, you know. It's one of those things. Also, there's other people that are like that now, but they're in the industry, and then they also judge, so they still kind of have the industry thing to kind of set their hat on, so to speak, whereas yours is completely revolved around that side of things.
Yeah, actually, you know, when early on, I kind of, you know, I had thought about actually trying to get a job in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think I had actually applied and interviewed for a job for a company manufacturer in the Northwest.
with funny owner's manuals by chance?
Yeah. Yeah. Which I aced technical writing. So it actually would have worked out. But I think because at that point I was fresh out of college,
right,
had no experience in the industry, they offered me kind of a lower level job. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I got offered a pretty good job in my career with statistics.
Okay.
So that's why I went that direction. But after that, I thought, you know, I don't know if I ever want to be in the car audio industry,
right,
because I would hear people getting burnt out,
right,
but their job is in car audio. So what are they going to do? Quit their job and just compete, or quit competing and just do their job? I said, well, if I don't get a job in the industry, then it's going to be harder for me to get burnt out.
Yeah.
So that was early on. I did want to make a comeback as a competitor, actually, with my Suburban.
Right.
But again, with my career, and my family, and then getting asked to judge so much because nobody was judging in the Northwest.
Right.
I didn't have time to work on my car. I still don't really have anything in this Suburban. Dude, it's just sitting in the garage. And of course, now I had realized I'm probably never going to be able to compete because now how's
right,
yeah. Hey, here's the owner of Iasca. He better win. Right. It's like, okay, I guess I can't do that.
So, impossible metric to live up to. And then everybody would say that you cheated. So
yeah. So there was that. But early on, of course, when I started judging, you know, college student still, didn't have a lot of money. I loved listening to music in cars, kind of custom cars and stuff, and seeing the custom cars. You know, judging gave me that outlet to, like, listen to really good cars and not spending my own money on it, you know?
Even better.
So it's like, wow, I get to go listen and sit in that car. It's not my money, you know? And so so that kind of got me through not really needing to compete back when I was in college and stuff. And then, yeah, time just went on, and it wasn't that I didn't want to compete. It was just I didn't have time to work on my truck.
Right.
But at least I got to listen to all these cars. And then I become friends with so many people, and it's just this kind of amazing networking that I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, I'll just keep judging and meeting new people and listening to them spend their money.
Is there any advice that you would give somebody who is looking, like, interested that they might want to compete in car audio and might even have a system that's capable of that but hasn't taken that leap yet? Is there any bit of advice you would give them to step out and join an event and participate?
Yeah, I would say just go to the event and just have fun. Whether you want to compete or not, that's a whole nother different thing.
Right.
Go out, meet people, listen to their cars, see what you can learn to make your sound better. Mm-hmm. And if competing's for you, then you'll compete. If not, then hey, at least come out and kind of enjoy the show and just make new friends.
And last question, if you had one track to evaluate a system with, what would you use? I know, everybody hates that one.
This, yeah.
It doesn't have to be on the Iasca disc. It can just be a track.
There's one that I used to go to that I, of course, would listen to in my car. And it's probably because I'm such a Disney fan, which I don't know if anybody knew that, but I'm like a big Disney fan, but I would listen to, there's a long version of the Electric Main Street Parade.
Okay.
Or Main Street Electrical Parade or whatever. I forgot how it's called because they took it away. But that one, man, I just love that one because if it sounds right, if it sounds real close to what it does or what it did back in real life, then it's going to bring back memories, you know, of sitting there in Disneyland watching this parade. But
it's got a more visceral experience versus just evaluation.
Yeah, but it's got a pretty good range,
right,
too. It gets low and it gets high.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very Disney music is always really detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of their stuff, even just listening to like the Frozen soundtrack with my kids,
right,
it's like, wow, that is just detailed, you know? It's like, let's see a car play all this Disney stuff that I'm listening to.
Right.
You know, can it pick up all those details?
Right.
Yeah, that's probably, if I was forced to stick to one, that would be it.
And I would say too, from listening to your feedback after judging my vehicles, for example, you tend to pick up on your references of the actual instruments in their native, you know, native form.
Yeah.
And referencing that back to how they recorded on the track and then, you know, trying to reproduce that versus just flatly talking about something. I mean, I think the, like the timpani on the old Iasca disc was a big reference point of yours for how, you know, the bass should be because of how the decay worked and everything else and how a timpani actually works.
Yeah. Which is funny because 7th and 8th grade, I played timpani.
Okay.
And so it's kind of like when I was in 7th grade starting, I wasn't good at it. So I know how it's not supposed to sound.
If it sounds like 7th grade Travis, it's, you're getting a 10. If it sounds like 8th grade Travis, maybe a 15.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, maybe that's what helps with my judging is that I've played a lot of the different instruments or I've sat close enough because when I was in the band in 7th and 8th grade, I would play the timpani or the snare drum or bass drum right behind the trumpets and the trombones, you know, so I know what those are supposed to sound like. Right. So, yeah, there's just kind of all this experience that kind of builds up to, I guess, what makes me.
That's awesome. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you for doing this with us. Thanks for traveling down to Tennessee in the middle of November to do a crazy event. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks for having me.